Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is a member of the Select Committee in the House of Representatives on China, the Intelligence and the Oversight Committees, Illinois Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Laundry Sauce and Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it helps make this podcast happen. So please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. James, the presidential race really doesn't look any different this week than last week or last month. If it were held today, Trump almost certainly would win, certainly in a multi-field race. Biden, however, had a couple good moments, and since there haven't been many, it's worth noting. His speech to Morehouse College graduates was very good. I watched the whole thing. He sounded better than usual, struck the right notes to those black graduates, and handled a small protest very well. He mixed in some reasonably effective humor. Second, the oft-derided Biden team got a good deal on the debates. First one will be in June. No debate commission, no audience. Mics are cut off if someone goes on too long. I'm not sure these debates are actually going to take place, but Biden couldn't keep ducking them as he was being challenged. And this is probably the best deal he could get, and we'll just see how he does. If he does hold up all right, because expectations are so low, and Trump is out of control, as he usually is, it could be a small step back in a very long journey. These are all rather small moments, but Biden benefits from them, and we take what we can get. James.
He did fine. I don't know that speaking to Morehouse, I don't know if it didn't change anything.
No, but it was a good speech.
I know, but at least he didn't do poorly.
Did you listen to it?
We're behind him. We got to put some points on the board somewhere. And hopefully the debate, if it goes off, I share your skepticism. And what happens if he does poorly in a debate? That's a possibility, too.
He'll still be behind.
Okay, but I don't want to be, relentlessly negative here. But, man, he in order for president to win re-election, if they do five things, four of them have to be right. They really got to hit some marks here. And it's, he does something good, did the State of the Union. It had one point effect. I don't even know if it had that. If you look at the polling lines, they don't change. I'm really scared people are again here. Not open to argument, but does that mean you shouldn't make arguments? Of course not. You have to. And the conviction, if it happens, I think that the 22% that voted against Trump in these primaries, which has been pretty consistent, I think it's going to be a key. Do they vote? Do they end up voting for Trump? Do some of them vote for Biden? How do they break? They certainly is. They're reluctant as hell to vote for Trump because they come out and vote against him in a closed primary. So I don't know. I just don't know.
Well, James, I agree with what you've said. Look, he needs a theme. He needs several themes. When he campaigns against Trump, I don't buy the argument that a winning argument is he's a threat to democracy. He is a threat to democracy, by the way. I just don't think that's going to resonate with most swing voters. I think maybe that he's a threat to national security, if that's what his all of his former top national security advisors say, that might make a little bit of a difference. I think he has to remind people, he being Biden, of the chaos and corruption that marked the Trump years, which voters tend to forget. January 6th, all the people who had to resign because of corruption, the hundreds of thousands of COVID deaths that were preventable. And then several issues, abortion first and foremost. You can't trust Trump on abortion. I think people will get that. Several others. I think health care. I think that's a sleeper. I think the fact Trump is going to kill the Affordable Health Care Act and undo price caps on prescription drugs. I think that's an issue that will help some. It's going to resonate a lot more than important matters like climate and education. And then he's got to be like Tom Suozzi. He's got to take the immigration border thing on, knowing that he's going to, you know, it's one that's going to favor Trump more, but he's got to cut at least the problems he has on that. It's all a big order.
So, Albert, the two fundamental decisions that President Biden's campaign has to make. The first one is, what's your primary target? Is it getting under 30 and black voters to participate at a higher rate than it looks like they're going to be participating and at a higher percentage? Or what you're trying to do is get these loosely aligned voters, the kinds of people that are showing up in primaries to vote against Trump, or just the kind of people that don't like him. And they're not totally compatible. And I know the tendency is, I always say, well, you got to do both. Sometimes to try to do two things is to do nothing. And, you know, right now, Democrats are not losing elections, and they're not winning elections because of Democratic turnout. They're winning elections because these loosely aligned voters are breaking their way. So I don't know. The second decision that they have to make, and I'm looking for guidance on this, what is the line of attack? What is the narrative on Trump? Because there's so many things that you can say about Trump. And what we constantly say, well, nothing breaks through. And it might be that we just have a whole smorgasbord of attacks that we're doing, and what is the best line of attack? We know that abortion is part of it, but is disorder the line of attack? Is criminality the line of attack? I don't know, but we there has to be clarification, and there has to be strategic focus on who are the voters that are our prime targets, and what is the negative line of attack we have on Trump? And I don't see either one emerging yet.
Well, I think you're right. And we will keep on this. We'll keep on this here. And by the way, James, you also can listen to some of James Carville's great wisdom on our Substack, Politics War Room. So please go there too. But this will be something of great discussion for the next 5 months, because they have not settled on that strategy you're talking
right.
about.
It's got to be something of great resolution in the next 5 weeks. Yeah. And it's hard, because to do one thing is not to do another thing. And so often in politics, the easy answer is let's do both.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Anything else on your platter, James?
There's a lot of stuff, but I mean,
a couple primaries, but not really important ones. I mean, the left wingers.
I didn't see them being much, was it? I didn't see much.
Well, left wingers got defeated in Oregon. You know, there was a congressional race out there to challenge a Republican who's marginal, and the DCCC invested in the moderate progressive, which they rarely do in primaries, and she won. So
I'll say something. I am a big fan of the DCCC. Okay, I know it's very, no one's ever a fan of congressional committees. It's raise money and they do this. I mean, their strategy of helping these crazy conservatives win primaries, I mean, all the hoo-ha and angst and everything else, it was successful.
Yeah.
And the fact that they have the guts to get involved in a primary to see that the strongest person wins, I think, my hat's off to them. I think they exhibit some courage, and I think they're about winning elections. For the life of me, and if I had one question I'd love for the Biden White House to answer, why are they so afraid of the left? I mean, they fucked them up on immigration policy. They can't even win in deep blue areas. And they come into conflict with loosely aligned voters that we have to have. They have very little connection to Black America at all. Yet, they proportionally punch way above their weight. And somebody understand it. There got to be a reason for it. I don't see why people even fear these people. I really don't. And they're just a drag on everything. But one day someone will explain it to me.
Let's hope they explain it to you, because they've changed their view and they've managed to win an election in November. But we'll see.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, James, our guest is Illinois Congressman Roger Krishnamoorthy, one of the really influential Democrats in the House. He's the ranking Democrat on the Select Committee on China. He's on the Intelligence Committee, and he's on the so-called Oversight Committee. Congressman, welcome back to our podcast. Let's talk China first. Two pictures emerge of China. One, it's a belligerent threat that seals our intellectual property, increasingly repressive on human rights and dissent. Vladimir Putin's best ally, dominating trouble in the South China Sea with clear designs to take over Taiwan this decade. The other is of a China in decline economically, huge demographic problems with a shrinking population. For all its military aggression, it can't match the U.S. naval power. In the aftermath of the COVID lockdown, it has, in the words of the New Yorker's Evan Osnos, a feeling of ineluctable assent that it used to have has waned. Which comes closer to reality?
I think it's probably the latter at this point. I think that it's a place that has some big time problems, as you know. It has 22 to 25% youth unemployment. It has an economy that's on the brink of massive deflation, which we haven't seen in any large economy in a long time. Their real estate bubble has burst, and so property values, which property, as you know, is a very large part of their individual consumers' net wealth, has plummeted. Their stock market has slid tremendously, and consumer confidence is nowhere to be seen, especially after basically zero COVID, the zero COVID policies and succeeding a COVID lockdown really shook people's confidence in the government. All that being said, they have the world's largest Navy. They have $3 trillion in foreign currency reserves, a huge population, and they have a leader, Xi Jinping, who seeks to, pursue aggressive policies economically, militarily, and technologically toward his neighbors and others, including the United States. And so because of that, you have to take them very seriously and you have to deal with them appropriately.
Well, okay, let's talk about the best way to deal with them appropriately, because I'm sure this is going to be debated heavily in the general election. Biden is taking a page from the Trump's playbook and imposing big tariffs. Is that one right approach, or what's the general approach you'd like to see us take to China right now?
I think the Biden administration has actually done a good job, Al. I think that on the one hand, they've pursued meaningful talks at the highest levels between, for instance, our military leaders and their military leadership to make sure that we can de-escalate the potential of conflict in the South China Sea and near Taiwan. We are also explaining to them, our policies with regard to, potential dumping of economic goods, green goods that could really destroy our industry, whether it's in EVs, batteries, or elsewhere. So we're having those talks. At the same time, I think we're protecting our interests by putting in place certain investment controls, outbound investment controls, as well as technology export controls, so that we don't necessarily either invest or send technology to them that could be used against us. I think that is the right combination of policies. At the end of the day, Al, I think it really, our policies should be calibrated in part based on what Xi Jinping decides. If he decides to kind of, he's at an inflection point. If he lowers his level of economic aggression, military aggression, technological aggression, which, by the way, I think would help their economy, because this aggression is rattling people's confidence in investing in their economy, for instance. Then if he does that, if he lowers the tensions, lowers the aggression, I think that we should lower our countermeasures potentially. However, if he pursues the policy of aggression, increasing tensions in all of those different areas I mentioned, then we're going to have to protect our interests and work with our friends, partners, and allies to do the same.
Well, you mentioned our allies. The other thing Biden has done, in comparison to Trump, he really has rather successfully forged, I guess I call it a counter-China alliance in the region, Japan, South Korea, Philippines, Vietnam, Australia. How much does that matter? How do you think Xi Jinping sees that?
It matters a ton. It matters a great deal to the CCP, because Xi Jinping has sought to divide us from our friends, partners, and allies, and pit us against each other over the last 30 years. And in doing so, has really eroded certain international norms or rules of the road, whether it's with regard to economics or security matters for that matter. And so what we have to do is we have to bind together and say, look, no, there are certain international norms that we are going to enforce against the CCP and anyone. For instance, none of us will tolerate invading a sovereign country or aiding the same. That is obviously relevant with regard to Taiwan, and certainly we see what's happening with China aiding Russia and Ukraine. None of us will tolerate the use of slave labor or forced labor in the production of goods that you export to other countries. Unfortunately, there's a Uyghur genocide happening in Xinjiang province today, where they are forcing Uyghurs to produce goods that they then export abroad. And then finally, none of us will tolerate dumping, the dumping of goods beneath the cost of production in a bid to basically destroy their competition. And that is very important and relevant today, because they are about to unload electric vehicles throughout the world in a way that would basically destroy Detroit, for instance, if we were to allow them to flood our market with those goods.
Let me try one more and turn it over to James. You mentioned Taiwan. Many China experts think that Xi's design is to take over Taiwan by the end of this decade. Are we being sufficiently supportive of Taiwan and prepared to go to war if he does that?
I believe that we have stepped up our efforts to equip Taiwan with what it needs to deter conflict in a big way, but we need to do more. We also need to work with our friends, partners, and allies to do the same. And I think the Biden administration has taken Xi at his word that he wants the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, to be ready to successfully invade Taiwan by 2027. And by the way, when the paramount leader says something like that, usually they execute on what he says. And so we should take that very seriously. At the end of the day, if I might bring up a poll that I read that is relevant to this issue, recently, a poll was taken of Americans saying that they thought, a majority of them thought, that there's a greater than 50-50 chance that a war will break out between the United States and China. In that same poll, 80% of respondents, and that was Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, all said that we should do everything in our power to prevent war, to avert war. And I think that if a conflict were to start, it would be over Taiwan or in the South China Sea. And so now we have to step up our efforts to deter that conflict, and that means equipping Taiwan with what it needs to really prevent the aggression that Xi Jinping might deploy toward them.
James.
So, Congressman, put yourself in a position that you're a top advisor to Xi, and you are, at core, a Chinese nationalist. And they're talking about invading Taiwan, and you're not too sure this is a good idea. What would you tell President Xi why invading Taiwan in 2026 or 2027 is not really a good idea for the interests of Chinese government or Chinese people?
It's a great question, James. I think that if I were somebody who would discourage him from doing that, I would probably argue two points. One, they would fail militarily in doing so because they would be overmatched by the U.S. and our allies and partners in equipping Taiwan with what it needs to defend against such an invasion. The second is, I would argue that given their tanking economy, they could not possibly weather the sanctions and all of the countermeasures, economic countermeasures that the world would deploy against them. And I think that the combination of those two arguments is really trying to drive at the fundamental issue, which is there's nothing that Xi Jinping cares about more than retaining power. That is his fundamental goal. And if he were to undertake an invasion or any type of military aggression, such as what you just described, it would shake the foundations of his grip on power and the CCP's grip on power. One of his beliefs is that the CCP is essential for unifying China, and that only he can exert the type of control necessary to unify the otherwise fractious portions of China that in the past have kind of divided the country. And so I think that would be the most powerful argument that I would make.
So Congressman, I know very little about international trade, certainly not going to pretend I do, but at the end of the Obama administration, they put forward the TPP, Trans-Pacific Pact, I guess you call it, which was all of the Eastern Pacific nations and, you know, U.S., Canada, and West, in South Korea, Japan, you know, Thailand, Australia, the usual suspect. It struck me as a pretty good idea, right? And then Trump came in and blew the whole thing up. Do you think it was a good idea? Is it still a good idea? And is there any chance that we could reconstruct this pact? Or it's just a dead issue.
Are you trying to get me in trouble, James? That's a tough question, man. Look, I think that here's the truth of the matter is that I think that we need to do something that increases our economic partnership with those countries, those friends, partners, and allies who might otherwise turn to China if they don't have a way of doing more business with us. And so the real question is, can we develop trade agreements that incorporate the labor and environmental standards and other things that kind of level the playing field between Americans and, for instance, the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese, by the way, the last time with the TPP, Vietnam was one of those real sticking points because people just didn't trust that Vietnam would adopt some of the standards necessary and enforce them, more importantly, such that Vietnam wouldn't become a backdoor for Chinese manufacturing and export to the U.S. through a free trade agreement. all that being said, I think now if we don't figure out a way of maybe even having such standards as USMCA standards in free trade agreements with others, I am concerned that some of those countries might turn back to China's orbit.
So, but before I turn it out, you're undoubtedly to understand the issues of technology and things, you know, better than the other member of Congress. How do we stand with China, like vis-a-vis AI, quantum computing, and stuff that I would never understand? But is our position relative to China stronger, about the same, weaker, just on the whole playing field of advanced technology coming online?
So, you know, talking to the experts, it appears that we have a lead in a lot of these areas, but that lead is diminishing. One of the reasons being that the Chinese are just throwing brute force resources and manpower at catching up. You know, in certain technologies like AI, unfortunately, they're using AI for nefarious purposes, such as with facial recognition models so that they can persecute Uyghurs, Tibetans, and other minorities. And so, and because they don't have privacy rights the way that we do, they've been able to really feed their AI big data sets with tremendous amounts of data and train them in a way that where they might actually have a lead in facial recognition technology. However, in a lot of other areas, we do maintain the lead. But one of the things I've argued and our committee has argued, actually on a bipartisan basis, is it's not going to be enough to hope that China stays behind us or to somehow, you know, make sure that they stay behind us. We have to run the foot race a little harder and faster ourselves. And that means, for instance, fixing our legal immigration system so that we can retain and attract the best and the brightest from the world, who oftentimes, by the way, are the innovators in these fields of the future, including AI or quantum computing or even biotech. And then secondly, we have to upgrade the skills of our workforce to be able to innovate and invest in research and development as well through NIH and NSF and DARPA and so forth. Unfortunately, those have been languishing in Congress.
Thank you, sir. Albert?
Congressman, as you know, after, I think, an inexcusable six-month delay, Congress finally voted assistance to Ukraine. But from what you read over there, Russia, it's taken its toll. Russia is on the offense, striking, taking over territory. The situation looks pretty bleak. Is it reversible?
I think so. I think that, unfortunately, because of our delay, they've just had to ration ammo. They haven't been able to do some of the basic things necessary to defend their territory. And so the Russians have made some gains. That being said, I think the gains have been somewhat modest. And now this pipeline is starting to get filled again with the armaments that the Ukrainians require to defend themselves better. Whether it's, you know, the ground-to-air missile defense systems, or it's the ATACMS, or it's, you know, other types of artillery. My biggest concern is that Putin has basically put his entire economy on a war footing, Al. And so he is going to throw everything and the kitchen sink at this particular battle, at this war. And he's also going to hope and maybe even interfere to try to get Donald Trump elected president. He's not going to make any moves in the direction of an armistice or any kind of resolution or anything like that until after the election. So we've got to pour on our support as hard as we can right now to get the Ukrainians in a better position.
Let me skip around. Assuming that you accept the fact that the helicopter crash that killed the Iranian president and foreign minister was an accident, a weather-induced accident, does it change anything in U.S.-Iran relations?
Not at first glance, because although Raisi was a hardliner, it appears that the second in command is also a hardliner. I think that what might change, and we're not really sure as of this moment, is there's going to be a time of, how do I say it? I don't want to say disarray, but there's going to be a time where they're going to have to figure out what's what within their leadership. And so that might be a time where certain voices that might have been suppressed before might be able to be amplified in favor of a more reasonable position, less hawkish, but I'm not sure. It's a very challenging situation in terms of their just general orientation. You know, the country has pursued this policy of nefarious meddling in the relationships of the region for many, many years. It's really kind of become more or less concrete within their foreign policy.
One more. You're also on the House Oversight Committee, which sometimes in the past has been a travesty under Chairs Dan Burton and Darrell Issa, but also it's done some serious work under both Republicans like Tom Davis and Democrats like Henry Waxman and Elijah Cummings. It's back to a clown show now under James Comer, featuring Marjorie Taylor Greene. What's it like to serve, to be on that circus?
Well, I think you saw what happened a couple of nights ago. And
yep.
It turns out that there's a clip that went viral, and I had no idea that I was featured in that clip. But I went up to the chairman, Mr. Comer, in the middle of that clip, and I basically put my hand on his shoulder and I said, "You need to adjourn these proceedings right now." And I could say that about basically the Oversight Committee as a whole for the entire Congress at this point. Maybe we should just adjourn for the year because it hasn't really done what it's supposed to be doing. And instead, it's been pursuing this impeachment inquiry, which has become, chasing down a rabbit hole might be a charitable way of describing it. But what I find is it really gives Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance, a chance to, to basically perform. It's become a venue for, performative activities as opposed to constructive ones. In the past, I was the chair of the Economic and Consumer Policy Subcommittee, and I helped to start the investigation of Juul and the youth vaping epidemic, and that has led to a lot of positive changes. I also investigated toxic heavy metals in baby food. We did that on a bipartisan basis, and that has led to some positive changes, as well as the opioid epidemic. What we're doing right now with the impeachment inquiry, or so-called impeachment inquiry, is a complete waste of taxpayer dollars.
James.
So, Congressman, I can't exactly know how to articulate this, but you're smart enough to understand what I'm saying. You obviously come from an immigrant family. And when Trump attacked the judge for being born in Colombia, that's the most anti-American thing that you can say. Who gives a shit where you were born, all right? You're no less or more an American than I am. And I just a question to you. They got a caucus for everything in Congress. Has anybody thought of having a second-generation caucus of all the people in Congress that are second or first generation of Americans? But you're obviously the most educated member of Congress. Thank God you're here. And it offends me in ways that I just can't articulate when you judge somebody about where they were born or where their parents were or any of that kind of shit. It just drives me nuts. So my idea is let's have a second generation or less caucus in the United States Congress and make the case for why immigration makes us a great nation.
Well, you're absolutely right, James. We do have a New Americans Caucus. I'm one of the few immigrants or naturalized citizens in Congress, and we get together a lot. And of course, there's a group of people who are children of immigrants. So they also very much relate to, you know, the immigrant story. I, of course, come from Chicago, which is usually the first stopping off point for many millions of immigrants to this country, as you know. But we've managed to kind of get along, and you're absolutely right. I think people in my constituency, 30% of them are foreign born, James, and they would find what was said completely abhorrent. We've learned to kind of get along in a way that maybe is a model for other places. We also like to use humor. When I first ran for office in Illinois, I said, "Hi, my name is Raja Krishnamurthy." And the person in Chicago looked right back at me and said, "Roger Christian Murphy. Very nice to meet you." And then he said, "I didn't know the Irish made it to India." And so, I think we've, you know, by the way, Vivek, remember that guy, Vivek Ramaswamy?
I'll try to forget.
You try to forget. Look, that guy, the other day he went on Ann Coulter's show or something, and Coulter told him, "I'd never vote for you because you're Indian." She just said it. You know, it's become like okay to just not only think it but to say it. And so we're kind of in that moment where I think this election has a lot more on the line than just who's going to be president, but what sort of values, what sort of norms we're going to tolerate in this country, and what our kids are going to. I know you folks have grandkids. I've got three at home with my wife, and I often wonder, like, what are they going to be, treated to in terms of what's going to be viewed as acceptable and not acceptable.
So I have something in common with your children. We're all third generation Americans. Who gives a shit where we started? Okay? My great-grandfather was born in Ireland, served in the Union Army, and was a Republican member of the Louisiana legislature during Reconstruction.
Wow. That's the American story, James.
Absolutely.
And I often think that we in Congress are stewards of that American story, the stewards of that American dream. And when we just tolerate this kind of nonsense within our midst, we are, I think some of my colleagues on the other side, they're adopting the most cynical of approaches, because they're hoping other people will condemn it or will reject it. They don't have to, because they're trying to curry favor with a group of people who, espouse values we don't believe in.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, I just want to say, whether it's Roger Christian Murphy or Roger Krishnamurthy, you are one incredibly valuable member of Congress and one terrific guest. You've been on before. I hope you'll come back again, because we learn a lot every time we have you on.
Absolutely. And if you want to do a Zoom fundraiser in October to help out, I'll be glad to come on and give you.
You guys are the best. And I can I just say one last thing? My father, one of the things he said at the dinner table every night, he said, "Think of the greatness of this country. And whatever the two of you do, my brother and me, just make sure it's there for the next families who need it." And you too, both of you were his heroes, were heroes to my family, because he watched you on TV every single night religiously. And he believed that you were kind of almost deities for what it means to be American and what's an American journalist, and just the best of America. So it's just such an honor for me to even be here.
Deity, I'm not sure, but boy, do we ever appreciate that.
We sure do.
Thank you.
You bet. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
James, now for the outrage of the week. There are some pairs that just naturally go together, Bonnie and Clyde. I'm going to give you a new one. How about Donald Trump, the worst and most ethically challenged president, and Dan Snyder, who was professional football's most disreputable owner, driving the once proud Washington football team into disgrace. Now, so why Dan Snyder and Donald Trump? Snyder, predictably a big Trump supporter, invested in a film, The Apprentice, about Donald Trump's early life, thinking it would be flattering. Instead, according to the showing in Cannes, it was honest. It would depict how he was, it depicted rather, how he was mentored and molded by the nefarious Roy Cohn, maybe the sleaziest man who ever lived, pure evil. So Dan Snyder is furious. I mean, he thought that these good filmmakers were going to make a flattering film of the Donald. Trump, of course, is threatening to sue. Bring it on, Donald. Of course, he won't. How would you like to depose Trump? I mean, that's a dream. You know, from what I have read about it and the reaction to the opening over in France, James, and if Snyder and Trump hate it, The Apprentice, I want to see it.
You know, that guy is, I guess he made a lot of money, all right? But he might have been one of the five worst owners in the history of professional sports.
And you might have trouble getting a 4-5.
Yeah, I'd have trouble. I'd have to, you know, think. I'm sure there were some pretty hideous people. But
the Clippers guy won.
Not much in terms of modern owners makes much sense, but I don't know what he thought he was doing, but I mean, I don't know. Mild rage is, I just cannot believe how far the Supreme Court has fallen and just how little they publicly give a shit. You know, so you had, which I'm very big on, Roberts' wife makes $10 million a headhunter for law firms that practice before the Supreme Court. Gorsuch can't sell his house, so he sells it to lawyer whose firm regularly practiced before the Supreme Court at an inflated price. Don't even talk about Clarence Thomas. I mean, you Harlan Crow, you got to be kidding me. All right, nothing. And then Alito, I don't know what that boy's mama did to him, but for somebody to obviously hate women like Sam Alito hates women, it's just not, to be born that misogynistic is not normal. I mean, forget they, you know, took a right away that women had had for 50 years in the Constitution. Forget that he has spoken approvingly about the Comstock Act, given that he's almost a definite vote to overturn Griswold, which gave people a constitutional right to access to birth control. He says he blames his wife. I mean, is this guy?
He blames his wife for the flag.
For hanging an upside down flag in his yard, and then says that he was offended because it was by a school bus stop, of which they pointed out it wasn't even in his school, and it was during the middle of the pandemic. And it doesn't matter. It's a conservative. He just keeps rolling on. They don't give a shit, or they don't exhibit anything. And I think the three liberals on the court. And they come talk about how to eat meatloaf together and that kind of stupidity. I mean, they got to stand up and be counted here. Now, I know they can't get the fire votes, but these kind of semi-acerbic dissents are not getting it. And the fact that these sons of bitches have no code of ethics, everybody else in the government, including federal district courts, has a code of ethics. A third grader has a code of ethics. And I just watching an entire third branch of government, an entire institution just self-destruct right in front of my eyes.
James, I've
never seen anything like it.
For any listener who didn't know, that upside-down flag right after the 2020 election was meant to symbolize the Trump line that the election was stolen. And you're right. They had the upside down flag flying in front of their house for maybe as many as 5 days, and he blamed it on his wife.
Yeah, everybody knew, and they said, "Well, the neighbor said something to them." I mean, come on, man! You're on the Supreme Court. You can't. You know, people go come in airports and tell me to go fuck myself every other day. They're not gonna put a treasonous flag up for it. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing just rotten. It stinks. Their legal reasoning stinks. Their ethics stink. And I don't think that most of them are very good people, to tell you the truth. I just don't.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
James, now for the listener questions. They're good as always. John in Staten Island says, what do you think about Trump's recent results in Nebraska, Maryland, Indiana? Nikki Haley continues to get up to 20% or more. Does that mean anything? Are the polls off?
It means something. I'm sorry. It just, you got 22% in your own party that come out in a closed primary to vote against the certain nominee. And this is it's always Dems in disarray. The Democrats have, we always have problems. Of course we have problems. But remember, they get 22% Republican primaries. An underappreciated number was Larry Hogan only got 67 in the Republican primary in Maryland, which says to me there's a lot of MAGA Republicans who don't want to move away from MAGA politics. And there's a lot of non-MAGA Republicans who don't want to move toward MAGA politics. And they have cross currents. I mean, bad cross currents. I mean, we have the progressive caucus and the suburban women and all the shit that you hear 100 times more than their problems. But they got, yes, it means something. What's really important is how do we exploit this uneasiness? And, you know, you try to get the Chris Christie's, the Liz Cheney's, the retired admirals, generals, State Department people, Justice Department people. I think these kind of things could be critical in this race to give people permission that don't like Trump to say, okay, you can do this. You're not going to do it again in the rest of your life, but you can hold your nose and vote for Biden. I don't give a shit how they come to vote for him, just how they come to vote for him.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. By the way, the once supposedly bright hopes Republicans had for Larry Hogan winning in Maryland, he's not going to win. That woman's going to beat him, and he's going to regret that he ran because he's trying to straddle a fence, James. He's trying to be both an O-line Republican, you know, and sort of anti-MAGA. You can't do that today.
You can do it a little bit in a governor's race. Okay, you can have a Republican governor of Maryland. You can have a Republican governor of Vermont. You can have, you know, Democrats can get elected from time in Montana and other places, Kentucky, maybe as good example as I can come up with. But it's hard when a race becomes nationalized.
In the Senate. You can't do it in the Senate race.
It's an entirely different breed.
Right.
And you and I have always agreed with that.
Right. And, you know, she's a good candidate. That Prince George's County win is a much better candidate. She beat the guy who spent a fortune. And,
yeah, I don't know her. I've been around the guy who spent a fortune. He was a pretty nice guy. But, you know, obviously the Democratic establishment, Maryland, rallied to her aid, and this is one time where the establishment matters.
Yeah, it does. And when you beat someone like that, you know, you get a lift. And look, Down Under, God, we love our listeners from Down Under. Damien in Sydney, Australia, says, with Biden struggling with younger voters, why doesn't he focus more on climate concerns? And with Trump's recent attempts to solicit $1 billion from the oil industry, this is particularly relevant. Why doesn't Biden do more on that? Damien, I'm gonna divide those questions, and you're probably not going to like my first answer. I think climate is an existential threat. I think you have to prioritize issues in the election. I think Biden ought to, you know, try to let as many young people know as he can about his position versus Trump's on climate. I don't think it should be one of his priorities. I think issues like abortion are going to be much more important. However, I think that what happened in Mar-a-Lago, which is the worst big money shakedown I have seen in 50 years of writing about this stuff, $1 billion from the oil magnate saying, hey, you give it to me, you can write your own bill. I think that's been undercovered, and I think it's been underemphasized by the Democrats.
So there's everything to support the fact that young people really care about Gaza, student loans, and climate, except evidence.
Right.
There's no evidence. All right? It just isn't. If you look at Delavope, who we're both big fans of, the Harvard Youth Poll, hardly something that's anti-climate or something. They're overwhelmingly consumed with economic issues. But to the climate issue, this is May of 2024. By mid-October, this country is getting ready to go through hell. It's 11 degrees hotter in Miami than the record today. Same thing is true at Key West, I think, was 17 degrees. We're not even hit June the 1st yet. The water in the Atlantic, in the Gulf of Mexico, is boiling. This is going to be, I say this as somebody who lives in a hurricane zone, lived in a subtropical era. This is going to be the summer from hell. Now, whether or not that in the insurance rates, the cost of living in it's going to be all up the East Coast. It could be North Carolina. It could be Virginia. It could be Maryland. It could be New Jersey. It's all up and down. This summer is going to change a lot of things in the United States. I don't think anybody is remotely prepared for the amount of heat waves that we're going to have, the intensity of these heat waves. And the Colorado State people, who are really good, one of the great questions, we always wonder, how does Baylor recruit athletes so well? How in the hell does Colorado State, the preeminent hurricane prediction center in the United States? I have no idea.
Because they don't have any in Colorado.
They don't have any hurricanes in Colorado, but that guy that runs that Klobuchar or whatever he is, I can tell you, people who live in hurricanes don't pay attention to that son of a bitch, and closely. And he ain't got good news. Not at all. Not good news.
Richard in Salisbury, Maryland, note, 17% of Americans, I saw this poll, believe Biden was responsible for Roe being overturned. Too many Americans have no idea about the infrastructure bill or the CHIPS Act. Really poor communications. Where is the messaging, James?
Well, 20% of the people in the United States think the earth is flat. I suspect there's a lot of convergence between the 17 that think Biden got rid of Roe v. Wade and the 20 that think there
is. Yeah, I just don't understand where the three is.
Yeah. They keep telling me, one of the things that the right does when they out of stuff, they say, well, look, the polls say this. I said, look, shit, the polls, 40% of people think the earth is 5,000 years old. You think the earth is 5,000 years old? Does that make it 5 because 40% of people say that? There's a lot of dumb shits in this country. There just are. And try as you may, the stupid people will always be with us. Now, Abraham Lincoln famously said, God must have loved poor people because he made so many. He's equally affectionate about stupid people because he made a lot of them too.
When Nixon appointed a Supreme Court justice that was thoroughly mediocre by everyone's admission, Senator from Nebraska, Roman Rusko, said that mediocre people deserve representation, too. I guess stupid people do also,
James. Yeah, they're over.
That's that 17%.
Right.
Gary in Las Vegas, Nevada says, why is Biden going to debate Trump? This only gives legitimacy to this evil right-wing lunatic. Gary, first of all, as we said, I'm not sure it's going to take place. I don't quite agree. Yeah, there's risk. There's sure risk. Expectations are low. I think Biden actually had to set this up the way he did. And let's not pretend that Donald Trump is Jack Kennedy. He's been terrible in most debates. He gets out of control, and I'm not going in with high expectations if it takes place, but I'm not as worried as you are.
Well, first of all, I haven't accepted it. He did get the upper hand for now, because it all depends on how he does. And, you know, I agree with you. I'm skeptical as to whether it goes off. And Trump, I think in the end, he'll just back out. The idea this guy was going to ever testify was like, and of course,
James, he promises he would. Do you think he broke his word?
Shit. Shit. The idea that this guy was going, my guess is he doesn't show up. And he'll fake some fucking fake excuse that Biden didn't take a drug test. I'm not going to do it. I'm betting against the 27 June debate takes place.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree. I mean, I really don't. John in Trinity County, California. James, where's Trinity County?
I'm thinking, and if I had to guess, I'm gonna guess Northern California.
Yeah, it sounds like Northern.
I guarantee you, what I'm gonna do is look it up.
Okay, good. Good.
Yeah.
We will find out. John asked, several sources said Israeli intelligence knew about the October 7th attack. Is it possible they thought it would just be a few rockets, saw it as an opportunity to retaliate, and let it happen?
I think it was massive, stunning, breathtaking negligence. I think that they thought they had a deal with the Qataris and everybody to send money to Gaza, and they had it all under control with work permits, and Jared Kushner and BB were going to make a lot of money. And I think it caused huge, massive negligence. That's what I think. And when you go to it, you cannot discount just how negligent that they were. It's impossible to even come. It was 10 times worse than 9/11. That's how bad it was. And the tolerance for this, by the way, Trinity County is located in the northwestern portion of California. So I've got our guest one right.
You were right. Also, James, going to the Israeli point, obviously, Bibi was asleep at the switch because he was so intent on changing the judicial laws and changing the system to try to stop the courts from sending him to jail that he wasn't paying attention. And he was the one that had secretly, privately backed Hamas for years.
Correct.
That sometimes gets forgotten with his rhetoric, but anyway.
Right. It's you know, they've got to blame Hamas because they wanted that did the attack. Okay, I understand that.
I do it, yeah.
But totally. But if you know, if you don't lock your goddamn door and you live in a crime zone, you partially at fault too.
James, here's a question from Steve in Hudson, New York. It's along the lines we've been talking about, the problems with Biden's messaging. And he says, do you think it's time for Biden to embark on something bold like a whistle-stop train tour through the Rust Belt? He could give speeches off the back of the caboose, similar to old FDR. You know, that's supposedly out of style. I'm not sure that's a bad idea. I have to think about it a little bit, Steve, but I'm really not sure that's a bad idea. You know, you could control it a little bit better. Maybe you could get good crowds, kind of, you know, brings up memories of Harry Truman. But, you know, it's better than giving set speeches.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think the bus tour for us worked pretty well in 92.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They changed. But this is my thing. Why don't we campaign on the minimum wage? Okay, to Biden's point, it's enormously popular. It's hugely popular with young voters. It's hugely popular with young voters of color. It's hugely popular with suburban women, all right? And campaign on, and we fought, we just don't talk about it, raising taxes, incomes over 400,000. We, oh, there's not, We tend to forget this is a business of blocking and tackling. This is not a business of triple reverses. Put the fucking minimum wage front and center. Put a tax increase on income over $400,000 front and center. And let Mark Penn write op-ed, New York Times. Who gives a shit?
All right, James. You know, I agree with you, but there you have to prioritize too. So you're absolutely right on every one of those issues. But you're right on abortion. You know, well, I think drug prices is an important issue.
But we did something. We take credit for that.
I think a guy who wants to kill the Affordable Health Care Act today is a popular issue. Climate, as you just said a few minutes ago, is an existential issue. And I think they ought to take a position on all. The question is how you prioritize them and what's the package theme, if you will.
If you're having trouble with young voters and you're having trouble with voters of color, which we clearly are, the minimum wage is a golden issue.
It is.
And raise it to, I don't know, $14.25. I mean, just raise the son of a bitch. And all the research comes in, doesn't kill jobs. And by the way, people say, well, there's only so many people on minimum wage. But there are tens of millions of workers who get 20% above the minimum wage. And the whole downscale wage equation moves with the minimum wage. And I was looking at a chart of the real value of the minimum wage, and it is just god-awful what's happened over years. And this is just part, this low minimum wage is another part of the intergenerational theft that Scott Galloway and Kurt Anderson talk about so articulately.
Yep.
So I think of all of those issues, I actually think the minimum wage has more potency than almost any of them.
Not more than abortion.
No, I didn't know that, but economic issues.
But okay.
Abortion saved the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Without it.
Hey, Jeff in St. Pete. James, this is you are an expert on polling. He said, what's the issue with the Times-Siena poll methodology being called into question with many different sources? Even other pollsters are saying that methodology can't be right. I confess I'm not familiar with the argument.
It's like every other poll. Okay, the Times poll was no different than every poll that we see says the same thing. And, you know, one of the things that people do understand it, they find one thing about, well, we didn't have enough of this. There were too many Democrats. There weren't enough Republicans. There were too many, not there. You can find something wrong with all of them. But the chance that 50 of them that say the same thing is wrong, that's not remote. And I not sure the detailed way of how the Times drew that sample. I did a whole Substack thing on polls and what to look for and how you can tell.
That was a good piece. Everyone who wants to know about it, go to James's Substack piece.
Right. But that in the point is, if 50 people tell you have something stuck between your teeth, you might go in the bathroom and look in the mirror. And every poll was saying the same.
Yeah,
you know, some people don't like the way the CNN poll draws their sample. People don't like the way that if you do register, you do likely, or you do adults. But it doesn't matter that much. They're all saying the same fucking thing.
Yeah.
And I really have no, and thank you for the question, but it's when I start seeing differences in polls, then I'm going to be really curious as to the different methodology.
Yeah, no,
But I don't see, every poll looks the same to me.
I concur, totally. But listen, if we didn't get to your question this week, send it in again, because it's really hard to choose. They all are so good. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Laundry Sauce and Miracle Made, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen.
Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.